Welcome to the RQ0 Games Podcast, Episode 4, Japanese RPGs, Part 1. And thank you for joining me again for yet another RQ0 Games podcast. This week I'm joined by Andy Kitkowski, who, in case you don't know for some reason, he is, for one, my partner in crime in publishing the Made RPG in English. He's also, for quite some time, been working on the English version of another game called Tenra Bansho Zero, which he hopes to have out sometime this year. And if you want to know more about that, you should definitely check out the interview he did on Meanwhile, the Super Gaming Podcast, and I'll go ahead and post a link to that with the show notes. The discussion we had wound up running pretty long, so I'm going to split it into two different episodes. But anyway, without any further ado, let's get started. So this time around, we're kind of going to do a very general overview, and hopefully we'll be able to kind of come back and cover some of these topics in more detail. Well, we can cover them in a lot more detail, potentially, in future podcasts.
Sure.
So the first thing I want to talk about is kind of, and you definitely know a lot more about this than I do, how role-playing games, tabletop role-playing games, got introduced into Japan.
Yeah, it's not too much of a story, but the cultural foundations of how it happened are very interesting. I took a sociology in college, so I'm a total geek for this sort of thing, but it's interesting. Everything from Western culture came to Japan about 10 years later than normal. Or more. Like, for example, the biggest case is one that any science fiction geek in Japan will recite to on rote, which is basically how Heinlein's Starship Troopers came over to Japan in the late 60s, and that immediately basically became the foundation for Gundam just a few years later. And that's why it came out in the 70s, because of the time lag between the translation of Starship Troopers, yada, yada, yada. D&D came out in the U.S. in what, like late 70s?
74, to be specific. 74? Exact.
Yeah. I'm thinking more like, you know, like the AD&D, and that's when it, you know, really skyrocketed. Yeah. It took off late 70s. It actually didn't come into Japanese. No one really picked it up or really was aware of it until about the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, right around the time that those early Nintendo games like the Final Fantasy and the Dragon Quest were coming out, that's around the same time that these tabletop roleplay games just came out and were starting to gain a little bit of ground. First one, of course, being Dungeons & Dragons. Due to Japanese art and things like that, the interpretation of some things was a little bit different than it was in Japan than it was in the U.S., which is kind of cool. And then from there, there was a quickly made a homebrew slash, you know, made in Japan sort of knockoff that was more kind of focused on, I would say, Japanese culture, in terms of the simple fact that you couldn't get polyhedral dice anywhere. You had to really have like maniac connections to pick them up. Everyone has D6s, though. D6s are classic. I mean, if you watch any classic Zatoichi movie, you know, where it's taking place in the 1700s, 1800s, you'll see that they had dice games all the way back, you know, 300, 400 years in Japan. Classic, right. Japanese dice, the small ones giant red one pit. Yeah, the one is a giant red dot. Very classic dice. So everyone can either find them or get them around you. Even if they have like sort of Yakuza connotations, you can still find them anywhere. So Sword World was the one that really sort of picked up, and that was the one that got around and got to high school clubs and college clubs and got the whole underground role-playing culture started. That was mid-80s. A couple more games came out after that of various popularity. We had Chaosium games came out, so Call of Cthulhu and those were translated into Japanese, and those became pretty popular. Basically, any Western publisher who tried to go out of their way and have a Japanese game published or accepted an offer to have their game published in Japanese for a reasonable rate, found some measure of success. Cyberpunk, Shadowrun, even Earth Dawn, all the World of Darkness games, all those came out, you know, mid-90s and the like. Yeah, and that's pretty much the foundational history. Now, the kind of interesting thing is that the earlier games, the Dungeons and Dragons, RuneQuest, the hero, the world of Glorantha was really popular early on. So a lot of the people that were into RPGs early on in Japan are kind of heavy Western fantasy grognards. Like, they know all the different types of glaives, you know, like how we have in the U.S. and you know, in Europe, we have these guys that know. Unfortunately, I'm not one of them. I wish I knew more about them than these guys do. But, like, you know, about the Battle of Sekigahara and who won and how many troops they had and what kind of armor they had, mm-hmm. how it was laced and things like that. I really don't know much about, you know, historical warfare at all. Some of the stories are pretty cool, so I wish I knew a little bit more, but I don't. But the people that got into early, you know, the Western fantasy and the role playing and stuff like that are those kind of people that know about that sort of thing, but like about Western battles and Western armor and things like that. So it's kind of interesting. The people who are classic, you know, I've been gaming all my life sort of gamers in Japan are ones that are usually really heavy into like Western style fantasy and sort of almost reject an anime-ish role-playing environment in favor of ones that are more crunchy, ones that are focused far more on like Western style fantasy.
So when I posted about the podcasts on Gaia Online, the one reply was about someone wanted to know a little bit about how Record of the Lotus War figured into all of that. I know both of us are a little sketchy on that, but
mm-hmm. So yeah, I've seen accounts of various levels of truthiness. One of these days I want to just go ahead and flat out, I'm on Mixi, which is kind of like a Facebook in Japan, and I'm part of the RPG group, and I might just kind of blurt it out, hey, can someone tell me the real history, point to links if you can, that sort of thing, about what was up with Record of Lotus War. But so if you look around or ask around or hear around, we've heard that if you look on like Lotus of the War fan sites and things like that, you'll find that it was originally the dude who wrote it. It was the setting was originally his home Dungeons and Dragons campaign. It's interesting, but it's also kind of hard to imagine just for the fact that once D&D came out, which it was again really popular. The Japanese equivalent, the Sword World game that I mentioned earlier, just exploded in popularity. And considering that a lot of times D&D is kind of shorthand for fantasy game, and the explanation is really kind of hard to break down, and also considering some of the classes and character types that appear in the game are sort of more Sword World centric than D&D. Or than I think of D&D, and the fact that later on that Sword World became one of the incarnations of it became a Sword World supplement. I'm actually wondering if it was originally just a Sword World campaign notes instead of D&D. Mm-hmm. In any case, it's one of the two, Sword World or D&D. This guy had some cribs and notes, I guess what? But it was first a set of stories, and then it became an anime. If I'm recalling correctly, what have you heard of?
I know that it was originally a series of replays, the transcripts of the guy's campaign mm-hmm. that were first published in Comptique magazine, which Comptique now is... I was surprised when I heard it was Comptique because Comptique I know, that's where Lucky Star is featured, and it's mainly magazine about like Bishoujo games, but apparently back then it was quite different, and so it was so there was a series of replays there, and then those got compiled into like three different books, and then mm-hmm. from there it kind of shifted over and became a series of novels, and then from there kind of transformed into a bigger franchise.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, in the West we had D&D, but then, you know, with random modules, and then random modules started to coalesce, and then we got this sort of background of this world out of it, and that, you know, became Greyhawk very quickly mm-hmm. once sort of like the Maker's campaign notes got out, right? And that's sort of what happened with Sword World. I mean, we had this idea of, you know, Western fantasy and adventures, and here's some random dungeons and things like that, but that was pretty much the first Japanese attempt to sort of put someone's campaign, you know, homebrew campaign world into liner notes. And again, it's fairly generic and all that, but then, you know, pretty much all the early stuff was. That's as far as we know, though.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to have to look into that a bit more, I think, to really be able to be authoritative about it. All right, so the next thing I want to talk about a little bit, and again, something we could do a whole podcast on, is kind of what makes the subculture of tabletop RPGs different there. And with getting into Lotus War, we talked a bit about replays. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what is a replay, Aaron? Tell us.
A replay is a transcript of an entire game session. Sometimes they'll even, you know, a lot of Japanese RPG books have them as like an extended example, because, you know, in Western books sometimes they'll be, you know, a transcript of like a page or so to kind of give you a little bit of a feel. But in Western game, or I mean in Japanese games, it's very, very common to have like an entire session's worth that really gives you a sense of, you know, how you get people together and, you know, make characters and go through the whole process of a game and how you tell stories through it. You know, they're in books for an example, and they're also put in separate books, which is what the Lotus War example is, just kind of to read for entertainment.
Sure.
People even read those just separately. And actually, there's an interesting anecdote about that. I don't know if you or our listeners are familiar with the manga Lucky Star, but the creator of that, his pen name is Kagami Yoshimizu, he actually got into role-playing games originally basically because he started reading the Lotus War novels, and he started really getting into them when he was like in middle school, and then he decided, you know, I want to get more of these, so he went to the bookstore and he bought a replay by accident. And it was by asking one of his friends what exactly he had bought that he wound up discovering role-playing games. And then years later, when his editor asked him to throw together a 4-panel manga really quick, instead of designing characters from scratch, he actually pulled out his scrapbook and picked out 4 of his PCs that became the 4 main characters for the manga.
That's cool. Yeah, I know so many people. In fact, the guy who redesigned Sword World, and some other friends, a lot of people in Japan, just like America, have got into role-playing games because they sort of stumbled on groups or a friend of a friend introduced them. But a lot of people, especially the ones that found it independently, you know, didn't see it from an advertisement or something like that, but rather mistakenly picked up a replay, read through it. It doesn't just, you know, leave you dry as to what it is. It actually will tell you, like, this is a replay, which is a blank by blank. Here's a role-playing game. A role-playing game is blank by blank. And so people will go through those. And so many people just said, wow, this is really fun looking. And that's how they basically got into gaming over there. It's sort of like an in to the scene. I've heard just too many stories, like firsthand, of like, you know, not a friend of a friend, but like, you know, I myself, you know, usually in middle school or high school, picked up a book X by accident, or saw this in a bookstore, or heard about this, and it looked so fun that I had to give it a shot myself. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you made a good point. The fact that a lot of RPGs in the West and anywhere will have examples of play, like it'll have, like, you know, just a little example of, you know, here's a GM and here's like 2 players doing an action to describe how an action works, or here's what combat looks like. Can you see their little combat play out? But replay is pretty much like from beginning to end a session, like from character creation, like from basically people like sitting down to the table, hey, and making light talk. To creating their characters, taking on the persona of the characters, going through the entire adventure, and then wrapping up at the end with comments.
So far the ones I translated from 8RPG, I think, are the only ones that have been done in English so far.
Yeah, you're right.
Would you say those are typical, or is it different?
They're semi-typical. Yeah. So in 8RPG, we've got about 3 of them. Three, and they are more or less complete game sessions. I think the first one actually ends saying, like, it basically ends with dot, 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 you know, and it goes on from here sort of thing. It is more of an example of play than a true replay, but it does go on for a few pages. And in that way, they are sort of examples of replay. So the interesting thing is, I mean, in Japan, the whole, you know, Dungeons & Dragons came out, the rules were there, but there wasn't really sort of that whole board gamey culture to sort of draw on. Like, I mean, you know, in the U.S., most of us learned to play by watching someone else. Over there, there wasn't a lot of that. So a replay was like a perfect tool, I guess, a tool where one didn't exist, to show people this is exactly how people come together. This is exactly what the flow of a game looks like. And of course, they're not just recording, like, you know, Joe Average sessions. They're like, yeah, I wasn't completely turned, you know, I wasn't completely on tonight. I was really tired. And, you know, usually they tend to focus on sessions and that you know, had a lot of cool stuff going on. So you actually get to see, like, you know, if all the players are really contributing and the GM's really on the ball, this is a sort of really fun kind of adventures you can go on. And that is sort of like the core of what a replay is. And that aspect of it, I think, is reflected in the replays that are included with Made, especially the second and third one, which are just a longer example of it.
Yeah, they kind of have a more coherent plot, and they both show off the different styles of play deliberately, I think.
Exactly. And they both go from pretty much beginning to end as well, without any you know, moving ride-alongs or anything. I mean, pretty much, yeah, it seems that basically someone had a, you know, as common when they do these things, someone had a tape recorder or something at the session, recorded everyone's voices, then went home and sort of wrote it up at the end. Yeah, and that's pretty much how they're made. So someone will bring a tape recorder to the session. Nowadays, you got the MP3 recorders and things like that. But like how some people will go home and they'll write little backstories for the characters, or someone else will go home and draw some, like, anime art about their characters. Someone else will go back home and sort of take it upon themselves to, like, write a replay or two, which is, you know, they leave a tape recorder at the session that gets everyone excited and sort of on the ball. They do their role-playing thing. Guy goes home and pretty much transcribes it line for line in sort of a screenplay format, complete with pretty much even side chatter, or even the LOLs, or as they say in Japanese, kakorai, the parentheses, kanji for laughter, end parentheses. Those are scattered everywhere, as you've probably noticed.
Yeah, and once in a while I see the www, which is really bad NetSpeak, but still.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that kind of confused me as well. What the heck is with all these W's? Yeah, it's basically LOLs, a W for wow or laughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was actually hard to translate to English. I don't know if you, like, when you see, like, you know, it's I don't want to, like, write LOL, you know, in the middle of a replay. But that's exactly what it is. How did you end up doing it when you see these?
I usually put just like laughs in parentheses.
How about this? How about bakuwarai, explosive laughter? How do you do that one?
Yeah, I don't remember, honestly. I'm not sure if there were any of the ones I did. And stuff with the way they use, like, stuff in parentheses is just really strange when you're trying to put it in English anyway. But the other thing was that I actually did do a recording of a session of Yuyake Koyake I did with my friends, and I'm probably going to type up a replay of it when I have the time to devote to and patience to sit down and type everything up.
Patience,
because, you know, you've got an audio file playing, and then I got to, you know, pause it every few seconds.
Yeah,
it's
exactly
going to take hours and hours. But the other thing that was actually interesting was that the other day I listened to the Cannon Puncture show. I'm pretty sure it was Cannon Puncture, where they interviewed Jason Morningstar about his new game, Fiasco. And, you know, he was talking about how he was kind of grappling with how to adequately explain the game to people, because he was finding that, you know, it worked great when he ran it, but sometimes it would fall flat when other people tried to run it to do blind play tests. So he was very seriously thinking about when he gets the final version of the game ready, putting in a replay. I think that would probably be the first original replay in a Western game.
Could be, yeah, I think so. At least from beginning to end. It'd be interesting, even more interesting, if he, like, sort of sold the replay separately from the book. One thing that you'll see a lot in Japanese games, especially when they have a new release. So, like, in Night Wizard, when they relaunched the game line, especially in light of the fact that it was going to be soon made into an anime, kind of mediocre one, but still an anime nonetheless. But basically, anytime a company releases a game these days, pretty much, like, in the U.S., we'll say, okay, here's the game. Like, you imagine from you know, Company X. Company X is a company that employs more than, like, one person full-time. You'll see core book come out usually with or quickly followed by the release of a supplement book, you know, in other words, to just sort of get the game a little bit knowledge and support and, you know, a little bit of extra out there in case someone wants to spend a little bit more. That's pretty much what happens with Japanese RPGs. I remember the game Dragon Egg Ryutama came out, pretty much was released, like the street date it was released. It was released, there's the core book, and right next to it, there's the very small pocket handheld replay. And which most people did actually buy both of them. There you got the book, which tells you the rules of play and gives you examples and stuff like that, and all the cool art that you expect from an RPG. And then the small book where you actually see four people actually going through an adventure start to finish and the fun they have, so you can sort of get your creative juices flowing to what you might run in your own games. Maybe we should talk to Jason about that. Don't put it in the book. Put it outside the book. Make it into a pamphlet. And maybe, hey, maybe someone will buy it separately without even buying the game.
But what else would you say, though, is kind of different about the subculture in very general terms?
Very general terms. Well, you've got the fact that...
I know it's just tiny, for one thing.
Yeah, it's tiny. Same in the U.S. I mean, especially if you compared it, like, when you compare the number of people as well, how many people are at home playing console games versus how many people that are playing... role-playing games in the U.S.? Well, just... tweak the numbers that much more, and that's pretty much what Japan looks like as well. The culture still doesn't seem to die. There's still more people coming in every day, yet it's still, of course, not super popular. In fact, I lived in a sort of an outskirts prefecture about 2 hours away from Tokyo, and during my introduction, I would drop the word TRPG, as they say in Japanese, tabletop or table talk, role-playing game, TRPG. And out of all the probably middle – let's see. They were all middle school kids. So about out of the 1,000, 1,200 kids I encountered, two of them had heard about TRPGs.
My older brother
heard about them or something like that.
I've never yet met a Japanese person who has heard of TRPGs other than when I bumped into the people at like Adventure Planning Service at Gen Con who are already working in the industry.
Exactly. Yeah. But if you happen to be over there and go to as long as you know where to look, I mean, sure, it's you could find people everywhere as long as you know where to look. I'm pretty sure the same thing is for like weird offshoots of anime or very specific elements of the cosplay society, like cosplay people who only work with leather, or something like that. You could probably there's thousands of them. You just have to know where to look, right?
Yeah.
In fact, my introduction to TRPGs in Japan was pretty weird. I was actually in over in Tokyo for about a year in college, and I was, of course, head over heels in love with RPGs, but I just didn't even imagine finding them. I looked in a couple bookstores and just sort of gave up. Didn't know where the game stores were, and the internet wasn't really the big. It was just taking off then, so no one really had web presence, so couldn't find anything. And right as I was just about to give up, I had given up. I went to a rave in the middle of Yoyogi Koen on Sundays. Used to close the street, and then they'd have like punk band next to like guys from Tokyo University breakdancing, next to hip hop like DJ wannabes, next to amateur princesses and things like that, and. There was a rave scene over there, and I was big into raves in the Midwest, so I went over there and hung out for the afternoon. And it happened to about the second time I went, I was wearing this – I wore a cyberpunk cap from Cyberpunk 2020, the role-playing game. There was a cap I bought at Gen Con right before I left, and it was just kind of cool looking, so I was wearing it. And then just – I met this guy who was kind of cool, and we were talking. He was pointing my head. He's like, "Oh, cyberpunk!" And I'm like, yeah, and imagining that we're going to have a conversation about the sci-fi novel, but – as we talked further, it was like, "No, I know about the RPGs," and he was my in. He showed me that there were actually, yes, there are RPGs in Japan. Here's the scene. So yeah, if either by random chance or if you happen to know where to look, you can find them, but otherwise it's going to be pretty much the same as the US. One thing I was thinking of that's different is that in the US, or probably in Europe as well, People don't have a problem with coming using their house as a forum for people to come and meet up, or their apartment or whatever. In Japan, it's not quite done as much. People tend to be more reserved about how they host guests in their home, and that's why you attend all these business meetings and business events and things like that. Whether they're formal or extremely sociable, they'll all be sort of outside at bars and things like that, at taverns, izakaya. But a lot of people don't usually use their own homes to move over grandfather's, because we're going to use the the living room, the one room that has a table to play on to do this. So that was always kind of a traditional, not problem, but just a little something that had to be worked against. That's kind of unique to Japanese culture.
One thing that struck me when I was reading Alshard FF was that in the book, literally, it suggests, because it explains the process of play in a very clear outline, from pre-play, get people together, make characters, all the way to after play, and it literally says maybe you want to go to a family restaurant to play, or go afterwards and hang out and talk about the game.
Yep. Go play or hang out at the family restaurant. Yeah, exactly. Family restaurant like Denny's or something like that, where you can just sort of hang there. The tea bar is $4, and that's all you can drink, and you can just sit there for hours, just like anyone would in Denny's. Another one that's always popular, and this one sort of is one that most foreigners kind of get a giggle about, is the fact that a lot of people actually tend to play at karaoke bars or karaoke. With karaoke
boxes.
Yeah,
you rent a private room.
Karaoke parlors, exactly.
And people just go in and play RPGs, I guess.
Yeah, when you think about it, it is the perfect place to play it. I wish we almost had karaoke boxes in the U.S., where basically,
actually. There are a few in my area, anyway.
In the West Coast.
Fuck you!
With the West Coast karaoke box. I live in North Carolina. We have, there's one Filipino karaoke bar in the state. But
they have a binder for American songs and one for Japanese songs and one for Korean songs. So.
Cool. Yeah, maybe you should try doing it sometime. Get a room and play, see what it's like. Record the experience. But it's a perfect place. I mean, basically you're in a soundproof chamber, relatively soundproof chamber, with tables relatively clean, there's microphones there if the GM wants to do scary voices. Otherwise, you're sitting in a room, and there's generally cheap food and drinks available by just giving the front desk a call. They'll bring up, pretty much gamer food, stuff that you find at, like fries.
Ramen.
Exactly. Yeah. Pretty much anything you want. Although one of my friends, Keiki Tozawa, the guy that I mentioned that redesigned Sword World 2.0, I met him at Gen Con a couple years ago. We've been fast friends since. He had a really funny experience, basically. He's like, I was talking about that. Like, I heard that, tell me about your experiences playing in karaoke bars. And he's like, I had kind of an unsettling one a little while ago, so we haven't been quite since. I'm like, really? What happened? He's like, so we're playing this game, Fuso Bukyoden, which is the Wuha warriors of old of the land of Fuso, basically a very Chinese themed Wuha game, sort of pretty much like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, very Chinese. In the game, you have these strips of paper where you write your name in elegant calligraphy on, where you use your Chinese calligraphy skills to write your name out, and you have basically this. You have these weird yin yang Taoist symbols that you have on your sheets of paper, what you put around. Anyway, so they're really getting into this game, and I mean, of course we're all nerds, but he his friends tend to look sort of normal ish. To continue the story, they order some food, and when the person from the karaoke bar arrived, they to bring them food and drinks and stuff like that, they were getting these really odd looks, the person came in like, here's a drink, and they just kind of they shut up really quick, and then just kind of put their drinks and food down and kind of scrambled away, and they're like, what the, shoot, and they looked down, and basically it looked like they were, I thought, what did it look to them like you were doing a cult you know, black magic in the middle of their karaoke bar. He's like, no, close. Actually, what it very much looked like was some recorded instances of Yakuza initiation ceremonies.
Oh, jeez.
And I'm like, oh, God. Because I could see it. I mean, I'm sure they weren't wearing dark glasses and things like that, but, you know, you just never know. So you got a bunch of people.
That's a plot from, like, a manga or a TV drama right there.
Exactly. Yeah. Go to the karaoke bar.
Karaoke bar, and like the poor lady who works there gets caught up, and yeah.
Exactly. So they're like, "Yeah, that was a little bit like a little strange slash embarrassing." So we haven't been since, but we plan on going again at some point. So you wouldn't have that experience in the U.S. Not, You might. Someone might think you're doing a weird occult practices or something like that, but no one would think you're having a Yakuza initiation ceremony in the middle of their karaoke.
Yeah.
Place.
Not really a concern around here. True.
Yeah, probably not, yeah.
Okay, so the next thing I wanted to get into was kind of what the actual designs of the games are like. What if there's some, if you can think of some kind of trends that are different from how the games are actually, you know, designed between Japan and the West. I know, obviously, we touched on before the thing about how, you know, polyhedral dice are kind of... they've gotten easier to find. Like, I know Sunset Games offers lots of stuff from Kaplow Games and Chessex and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
but they still, as you said, rely a lot more on six-sided dice primarily.
Yeah.
But what else do you think?
Well, what are some things that you've noticed? You actually have a collection of games as well.
That's true.
And any trends that you see?
Let's see. One of the major things to me is that the games are designed for very short-term play.
Uh-huh.
Like Al Shard FF, how it, you know, talks about, you know, it talks about the procedures of play and talks about like the social aspects of it in a lot of detail. And one of the things that struck me about it is literally when you read the list of different kind of ways to play in terms of length,
mm-hmm.
it says, you know, do a one shot, do like, you know, a short campaign with your friends, play at a convention, and then the idea of doing a long campaign is like in a sidebar off away from the main text. It's not even like a primary consideration. It's an optional thing that you might consider doing.
Yeah. I see that every now and then too. I think it, personally, I think it has a lot to do with the consideration that it's just plumb hard to get people, to get friends organized. It's almost unthinkable to get adults together on a weeknight. There's just too many social responsibilities to creep up, or just work things that creep up, or home or family things, or you know, hit side hobbies or whatever. That usually, pretty much the weeknights are pretty much right out for most people. That's when work or learning stuff happens, and thus that frees up only the weekends. And of course, not everyone is going to game regularly, weekly, for every Saturday period. So what I tend to say, unless of course, you know, you're in college. I saw that a lot when I was over in college over there.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, these guys are here every Saturday. But in the real world, you know, the people who have graduated from college or you know, even middle school kids that basically go to school 6 days a week and go to tutoring after school and things like that. They end up being left with Saturdays and Sundays, and usually only every few. So they got to make the most of the time. And probably the short-term campaign or one-shots or you know, 2 to 3 session games is pretty much a very sweet spot for that sort of realm of Japanese culture. Personally, I don't know many people that have actually, you know, we began at first level and we're now at 20th sort of campaigns. Even in D&D, people tend to pick up and they'll say, we're going to play this level range and then end, is some of the stories that I'm picking up.
Yeah, that's interesting too, because you know they have fully translated versions of the exact same D&D books that we have here.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then,
but the other interesting thing is if you look at like, you know, the early games that came out from the U.S., Call of Cthulhu is pretty much a one-shot game. Although I think that someone did translate Masks of Nyarlathotep way back when, the basically the phone book sized adventure supplement. Yeah,
the really basically crazy, like full campaign.
Exactly. I know some guys like, yeah, we played every single day or every single once a week, weekly for like 5 hours of the shot, and we got through it in like a year and a half or something like that. I'm like,
jeez.
Holy crap! But that one, you know, Call of Cthulhu itself, perfect for one shot or two shot or very episodic gaming. Other games that came out from the US, you know, Cyberpunk, you can do that sort of same thing. Torg was another big one for a while. That was, I mean, there was a campaign element to it, but you could really see that as a series of like one shot adventures back and forth. Shadowrun, you know, it's basically a string of single shot adventures.
Yeah, for not necessarily one shot, but very episodic.
Yeah, but that's very interesting because that's something I know about. But yeah, I never really thought about it as something that was a primary feature of most games. But now that you mention it, I am definitely seeing it.
And then also the way the especially the actual Japanese games, the character creation too seems to be really quick, designed to kind of rocket you into having a full character to play with.
Very much so. Yes, you're right there. Well, as I mentioned, games like RuneQuest and things like that are still very popular. You know, people play nowadays with the same rules they were 20 years ago, so there's not really a lot of games that try to sell off that. Every once in a while, a game will come out with a slightly more complicated character generation. I'm trying to think of Rokumon Sekai, the world of the six gates. Has, you know, takes you have to do a lot of number crunching, or the Shin Megami Tensei, game where you have to just pull out basically a calculator to calculate your character, that sort of thing. There are some games that ring off that, but it seems, yeah, you're right. It seems a lot of the games these days tend to focus on people that, you know, want to just get in there and get playing as fast as possible. Even with that, you probably notice it as well. But like the tendency to have your character made up of a few archetypes assembled together.
Yeah. Because like Alshard, you have classes and you just like pick out three levels of classes for your character, and that determines almost everything.
Which is brilliant. I mean, like you're like, I want to have an Elric type. Okay, well you're a fighter one, black wizard one, rogue one, or I want to be like Conan. Okay, you're going to be a samurai two, vagrant one. You know, so you have a huge range of sort of possible character types just based off of these few archetypes assembled together. Same thing with a game that I love, Tokyo Nova, which is basically the first Japanese sort of four Japanese cyberpunk game made. So it's a game that uses a card, like a trump card based system, and it too is basically, I mean, this was made in the or mid-90s, the same year that Castle Falkenstein came out in the US, I'm not sure, the 94, 95, something like that. And it, too, focused on, like, take three of these archetypes together and assemble them into a character. So you can have, like, the typical cyberpunk things, like, I want a sword-fighting policeman who also is somehow connected to the media. Or I want a rocker person who rides a motorcycle and is also a politician. You know, so you basically take these three character types, mash them together, and you have a character. Mm-hmm. And basically all it amounts to is you choose the character types you want, and then everything else is sort of spelled out for you. Okay, once you do that, your physical will be this, your dexterity will be that, your social will be this, just write them all the numbers down, okay, we're ready to go.
Yeah, and beyond that, the games from Fear tend to not only do they have the basic character creation where you just throw some archetypes together, but then on top of that, they have the quick character creation where you pick out pretty much a ready-made character.
Yep.
And make up and give them a name and just go for that if the already fast character creation isn't fast enough for you.
Exactly. Which I've actually capitalized heavily on for my Tenra playtest. Every time that I ran those early playtests, I was like, okay, I'm going to translate these archetypes and have everyone make their... And then game day comes and I'd spent too much time like translating the combat rules to get things in order. I'm like, okay, luckily I've got 28 characters, blank characters to choose from. So you know, just write down these dots. You write down those dots and we're ready to go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's really clever. And I think that actually played off, a little bit of coolness. I mean, it's some games will come with pre-made characters, but don't necessarily. It's more like for an example rather than here you should just rip this out and play. Yeah. if you really need it. But honestly, like say for example, I tend to go to conventions every now and then, and conventions usually have pre-made characters. I honestly find it really refreshing these days to not have to make my character from scratch, to just be like presented with a dude who's like, here are a couple personality elements, here's a couple background elements, go. Mm-hmm. And I like like that. It's refreshing. It makes me sort of break out role playing in a new way, I think.
Well, conversely, some of the Japanese games are kind of at that right at that sweet spot where, you know, if for whatever reason I'm not able to put together some pre-gen characters, if I'm running a convention game, I don't have to worry about it too much. It's not going to totally derail things because it's just like,
exactly.
Oh, you're going to make a character, and, you know, 10 minutes later, then we can be ready to play.
Yep. And the other cool thing about that, especially with the sort of the template-based thing, you can really tie a lot of characters together by having the GM sort of expressly say, please take this or don't take that. I was thinking, like, for example, that Tokyo Nova game, I was just looking at it going like, holy crap, all of a sudden I just realized I can make this into a perfect Ghost in the Shell standalone complex game where everyone is on a secret police force. I'll just be like, okay, you have to take the law dog template. Could be, you know, you have three template holes to fill. Each one does something slightly different. Like, has to be in one of those holes. Don't care which, but you have to put it in there somewhere. And then everyone is automatically sort of tied together. You can really get an adventure off to an explosive start that way, I think. And there's lots of other. I mean, we could probably just go on here all night with all the various things that are trends in Japanese games. But I definitely want to discuss this with you later. I'm sure we could probably break out a couple of these in future podcasts and sort of describe specifically, like maybe with scans of pages of RPGs, how these work in various games.
Yeah, definitely. And that's it for part one of this podcast. In the next installment, Andy and I continue our discussion, moving on to talk about doujinshi, kind of independently published role-playing games, and some neat games that have caught our eye recently in terms of Japanese RPGs, and finally some of the issues of localization that we've encountered in our respective translation work on Made RPG and Tenryou Bancho Zero. So I hope you will tune in. Thank you again.